earning wealth and just enjoying a lavish lifestyle and, you know, becoming people who are now forming that lavish class and, you know, creating that class of aristocracy. That is when people realize, okay, oh no. That is when the people realize that, oh no, the situation has become bad. People started to see that people like Abdul Rahman bin Auf, on one hand. On the other hand, people like Zubair, people like Talha, people like Sa'ad bin Abi Waqqas, those big heroes. What had happened to them? They had started to create this class. They started to just earn. They started to make use of the society instead of give benefit to the society. They started to feel that now is their time to just enjoy and live a lavish lifestyle. And it was not only them, there were others also that started to have this type of idea about Islam. This is when the society realized that, oh, there is a whole difference now in the society. There is a whole class difference. There is a class of the rich and there is a class of the poor. We are saying it was sudden, but it wasn't sudden. It was a gradual process with a specific formula that led to this particular division that existed in the society at that time. This is a problem, a sickness that had started earlier, a seed that was sown earlier that slowly grew until it became now this big problem that the Muslim society was facing. And it had to happen because of the way it began. And now when the sickness became very apparent and it started to manifest itself, this is when the human values became nothing. Humanity was forgotten.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the Islamic society and what befell on it after the Prophet and how this whole sickness of division and this class of the poor and the rich that was formed after that, how it came to be. And we realized that after some time when this sickness had spread and started to manifest itself properly, then even the human values were forgotten. Values had now just become apparent things. Who is a human being? What are those qualities that you need to achieve as a human being? Those things were forgotten. In fact, a human being is that one who makes use properly of his opportunity, of his wealth, of his energy. But unfortunately now, that was not the case. Values had overturned. Values had become apparent things. Who is a true human being? A human being is someone like Abu Dharr Ghaffari. And when Abu Dharr was exiled, that was when the community realized that Islam had lost its value in the people's hearts. That humanity was no longer important. When in a society a person like Abu Dharr cannot live in security, whereby a person like a person like Abdullah bin Mas'ud, his ribs were broken by the people, by evil people. This shows that this community, this society has now become far from its true reality. When in a society, a Jew, an evil Jew, not all Jews are evil, but we are talking about an evil Jew here in this particular situation. An evil Jew comes and he becomes the chief of the scholars in a Muslim cabinet. When he becomes that, and then Muslim people come to learn under him, this is when you realize the human society, the Islamic society is now deteriorating. This is when you realize that there is destruction happening. And Imam Ali alayhi salam was noticing all of these trends and he was trying to stop them. And let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that even in this day and age, we're able to stop these negative trends and try to create positive change in the communities. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state. A tax officer and his wife have set up a Pushpa tree and plant hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail. Deep poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge. Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species, and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems. But think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tagged to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset. Just tagged the giant, 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong. Geologists are rejoicing over a new discovery. A 290-million-old fossil forest has accidentally been found in southern Brazil. A team of geologists had been sent to the state of Parana to investigate the rocks there. To their surprise, they were able to find over 160 logs of lycophytes, an extinct variety of the vascular plant subgroup. It's quite rare occurrence that a large number of fossils of the plant were found preserved in upright position for such a long time. The forest itself was discovered in 2018 when a street was being constructed over there. So far, only two other similar collections have been found in smaller forest areas of Brazil and Argentina. Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turn barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most.
People in Poland have rolled out flower carpets for the feast of Corpus Christi held in the central village of Spiszemierz. Families usually arrange colorful and symbolic carpets for the procession on the road section in front of their homes. They use flowers picked from the surrounding fields or their own gardens. They also use soil, sand and fresh cut grass. The procession begins from the church and roams the streets of the village. The flower carpets have been rolled out annually since the tradition started 200 years ago, except for once when a storm broke out.
This tradition is 200 years old, and according to what the village elders say, it has only happened once that there was no carpet of flowers for the procession, because a storm broke out and swept everything away in the afternoon.
Families begin collecting the flowers a few days before the feast and arrange it on the celebration day. Besides its religious aspect, the event is also meant to express appreciation for nature. The practice has been passed from generation to generation ever since it began. The tradition was registered at UNESCO's cultural heritage list last year.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. I believe that having only one attribute or feature of Prophet Muhammad would lead a person to a religious life. This means to act like the Prophet in life. For instance, Prophet Muhammad used to say salam when he reached the people, whether young or old. This means to imitate Prophet Muhammad in all aspects of our life.
اگر کسی به خاطر که شبیه پیغمبر بشه همین رفتار پیغمبر رو تو زندگی خودش جاری کنه.
If we practice to live like Prophet Muhammad, which is of course a difficult task, then we will have a religious life. Of course, living like Prophet Muhammad is not easy. For instance, if we say salam and we hear no answer, we must not lose our hope. If we say salam and we hear no answer, the angels of Allah will answer our salams. So, to live like the Prophet is not easy, but we must do our best to have a religious life like that of Prophet Muhammad. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Kalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islam, dini wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about, the rules of Hajj Tamattu, and more in particular, we were talking about, we started, in fact, our episode from the last, previous episode onward, about the prohibitions of Ihram. Let's continue some of these, prohibitions or those things which are not allowed for any pilgrims to Mecca. Would you?
Yes, sure. We have already discussed some of the prohibitions, and of course, the one of the things which is prohibited for a pilgrim is, especially for women, is to apply collyrium, which is called surma. Okay, it's not permissible for a woman or for a man to apply collyrium or surma.
Yes.
For example, men, women tend to wear makeup and wear, collyrium, mascara, and different things. Yeah. And they might want to apply lotion or things like that, which is not permissible, of course. Yes, if you want to apply sunscreen, it does not have fragrance. There's mm-hmm. no objection because you want to protect your skin. Okay,
right.
That's okay because in the hot season you can do that.
But what about some of the ointment for medical purposes?
That's also permissible mm-hmm. if there's ointment, and of course you want to apply it. There is no objection to you in doing so. Then we have looking in mirror. Okay, in a mirror you. There are mirrors here and there, especially when you want to enter a hotel or a restaurant and there are mirrors in front of you. And these rules are applicable to, Shia Muslims. Sunnis might not have these restrictions, okay?
Right.
So they might want to look into mirrors. That is what we need to know. And we as Shia Muslims need to follow the religious authorities we have. And of course, in this program, we are discussing the rules according mm-hmm. to the fatwa or the verdicts of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. So looking in a mirror is not permissible. And if a person happens to look in a mirror, he has to pay the penalty or the kafara. Then we have wearing shoes. Wearing shoes is not permissible for men.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are special slippers or flip-flops which a man should wear. So the upper part of the shoes and the feet must not be covered. You cannot wear socks. You must wear special flip flops, and in order to avoid covering your feet. So
yeah, but these shoes, most of these shoes are sewn.
No,
you know?
That's not called clothing. You know, it is, of course. You need to wear something. Footwear is necessary. You must. You cannot. You can walk barefooted, but if you want to wear something, you should wear something which does not cover your feet.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the upper part of your or the upper sole of your foot.
Yeah, the sole. Yeah.
The sole should not be covered.
I see.
Then lying is absolutely forbidden. It's always forbidden, but lying, especially in the for a pilgrim, is absolutely forbidden. Quarreling is forbidden. No one has a right to quarrel with other pilgrims while performing Hajj, because it is a season. It is an occasion for reuniting, for showing
for peace and prosperity.
And
yes.
Prosperity, sure. So quarreling is forbidden. Killing lice or other insects found on the humans. Okay, if you find any insects on your body. Walking, like for example, if there are cockroaches, or if there are lice, or if there are insects, flies, okay?
Mosquitoes, yeah. Flies, yeah.
Yeah, you cannot kill them. You should just simply push them aside.
Okay? Drive them away.
Yeah, and killing insects, animals, will make atonement obligatory.
I see.
And then beautifying oneself, okay? I did say that wearing makeup is not permissible. Beautifying oneself, wearing jewelry, wearing adornments or things like that is absolutely forbidden, and no one can do it.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take another break or a short break here, and we'll be back and continue our program. Some of these rules regarding the prohibitions of Ihram here on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the rules of prohibitions of Ihram, according to Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, you were talking about those rules. If there are anything left, I'd appreciate you actually to shed some light on it.
Sure. One of the prohibitions of Ihram is to apply oil. Okay. There are many pilgrims, especially Indians and Pakistanis, who are very much in the habit of applying oil. And necessary or unnecessary, they do it.
What is it for?
They apply oil to their hair, to keep their hair tidy, or to keep their hair strong. And of course, applying oil has its fragrance as well.
Uh-huh.
So it's not permissible to apply oil. Oil is a term that can refer to many different things. Lotion is also included. For example, lotion is also a kind of liquid that's applied to the body. So,
but what about moisturizing, for example, the skin?
If it's not necessary, it's not permissible to use moisturizers.
Except for some medical purposes,
yeah,
right?
If
you have a condition, medically
necessary,
speaking.
Unless necessary, one should not apply such things. Then we have removing hair from the body. It's not permissible to pluck your hair. Ladies cannot pluck their eyebrows or pluck their hair unless the hair falls off itself by itself.
Right.
It's not permissible for a person, man or woman, to remove his or her hair, because you will have to wait. If you are performing Umrah, you will have to wait until you are supposed to perform Taqsir. Taqsir is when you have completed the sa'i and you have performed the tawaf, and then after tawaf you will perform taqsir. Taqsir means that you cut short your hair or your nail. That's when you are allowed to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then we have halq. Halq also means to shave. Okay, shaving is the last practice before the tawaf and nisa. Of course, you are supposed to perform halq, which means that you will. You will clean shave or you will shave your hair, and that is when you are allowed to do so. Otherwise, before you complete the Hajj rituals, you are not allowed to pluck your hair. Then we have covering the head by males, or driving, diving in water even by females, you know. So to understand the rules better, I want to say that there are some, you know, the weather is hot there. Many people might want to take an umbrella, you know, and walk and use the umbrella to cover themselves and to walk under the shadow. Walking under the shadow is not permissible for a person who moves from the station, from Miqat, towards Mecca. Of course, once you arrive in Mecca, this restriction is removed. Okay,
right.
Because while you are walking in the streets of Mecca, okay, shadow is there. You'll walk into the hotel, but as long as you have not reached there, you cannot walk.
Use an umbrella, you mean?
You cannot use an umbrella. You cannot cover your head. You cannot wear a hat or something, or a cap to cover your head.
Even so, despite the fact that some of these, time frames, I'm talking about the Zilhijjah time or month, which fall into the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes really extremely hot. In Saudi Arabia. So
there are two things. Of course, the weather is hot there, but we need to distinguish between covering the head and walking under the shadow. These are two different things.
Uh-huh.
Okay, sometimes the elderly people, they always cover their head even if they are not performing Hajj. So covering the head is not permissible. It is necessary to remove the cap, to take it off and walk without wearing anything. Okay,
I see.
But walking under the shadow, it's not permissible, and regardless of whether you are a man or a woman. Okay. Covering the head for ladies is a must. It is obligatory. They should cover their head and hair and neck and everything,
mm-hmm.
except for their faces,
right.
and hands up to the wrist. So as for walking under the shadow is concerned, of course, they cannot walk under the shadow whilst they are wearing ihram and moving towards Mecca.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice elaboration and shedding light on the rules about the prohibitions of ihram here in the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malajan ilaha illahun Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Sami'un Basir La ilaha illahun وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
He was a teacher.
On December 12, 1925, in a totally undemocratic move, Mr. Reza Pahlavi is appointed the king of Iran. During these days, when the world is taking a fresh breath of temporary peace after World War I, Reza Khan Mirpanch sets his sights on creating fundamental changes in Iran. Different tasks, including the construction of a nationwide railway system, banning all Islamic veils, the establishment of Iran's first civil laws and other such activities, the founding of a modern education system, is among the first orders of Iran's king, who wears a military uniform. Only a few months after the coronation of the new Shah of Iran, the government is tasked with the development and expansion of education at the elementary level. Old schools under the supervision of clerics are shut down and replace with schools with teachers who are not clerics and follow the guidelines of Reza Shah's Ministry of Culture. With the establishment of a General Office of Writing, drafting educational books for elementary students begin. The Shah's goal from this action is to unify school books and have direct supervision on what students are being taught at schools across the country. This supervision can be defined in one thing: nationalism and love of the Shah must be included in all school books. In early 1951, when Reza Shah's reign has come to an end and Muhammad Reza Pahlavi replaces his father on the throne, the English teacher at the biggest school in Qom, which is known as the second Dar ul Funun, is a young, well-dressed cleric who wears sunglasses, and people point him out in the streets and say that he can speak a foreign language. Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti was born in Isfahan. He was a seminary student at the Qom Seminary School and a university student at Tehran's college. He was talented and an elite student. He chose teaching to make a living. He is not financially well off, but he is very different with the rest of the seminary students. He doesn't charge anyone tuition, writes his daily schedule on a piece of paper, and hangs it up on the wall in his room. His appointments, when to chat with friends, he's even defined joking for himself. When he becomes a top student during his BA course, they propose that he either stay in Tehran and take on an official job or become a teacher in the education system. He chooses teaching and Qom. Because of his command of the English language, the education system accepts him as a teacher at Qom's Hakim Nizami High School. In his memoirs, he writes, "The beginning of my political activities based on Islamic motivations is related to the year 1950. When Ahmad Qavam made his famous bullish speech and I heard it on the radio, I left the house instinctively. It was a very interesting feeling for me. I didn't even know which direction I was going in, but I knew I shouldn't be at home." The nationalization of the oil movement and the link between Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti with struggles of Dr. Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani are the beginning days of the young teacher's life, which was full of ups and downs. From then on, his presence in many of the political gatherings in Tehran becomes serious. On August 19, 1953, with the defeat of the nationalization of the oil industry through a coup d'etat, many had lost hope. But he would say, "No matter what condition they create, we'll come up with a new plan for it. Our problem is that we do not have enough organized members, and we have to, under the cover of a cultural movement, train them." The same idea, training members, was a spark that helped establish the religious and knowledge of high school in Qom. It was the first school which was established with efforts of the son of the founder of the Qom Seminary, Ayatollah Hayri Yazdi, and the young Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti is put in charge of it. Now, with the establishment of the religion and knowledge school, Beheshti's extremely important and serious activities begin. Everything is done under his supervision. The school becomes one of the best schools in the country very soon. Beheshti's seriousness leads to the acceptance of all the students of the school in the entrance exam who had graduated in its first year. But his main goal in this school is training people who will play important roles in movements in the country. The entrance exam shouldn't be a preventive barrier when it comes to the students educated at this school. Mid-50s and Sayyid Muhammad is almost 30 and successful and well-known. His organized lifestyle helps him juggle a number of activities well and simultaneously. He studies in Allama Tabatabai's classes for 5 years and Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Muhaqqiq Damad, who is strict when it comes to calling someone a mujtahid, explicitly calls him one. He also passes the Islamic philosophy doctorate exam held by Tehran University. In 1956, with the establishment of the Intelligence and Security Organization of Iran, known as SAVAK, the heavy shadow of the government's cast clouds over the entire country, an organization which becomes scarier and more ghastly by the day. During these years, Beheshti comes up with a new idea: teaching modern sciences to seminary students during the night shift at the Religion and Knowledge School. He believes that seminary students must be educated like literature diploma holders and in being familiar with English, Arabic, and natural studies. This idea attracts about 30 seminary students interested in learning to the Religion and Knowledge School in its first term. Now everyone calls Sayyid Muhammad Dr. Beheshti. A doctor who, in addition to all the work and attention that he has in school, is well-read about Islamic economy, the banking system, and issues related to Islamic governance. He even exchanges views and ideas with seminary students and university professors. He sets up a group made up of Mr. Musavi Ardabili, Mahdavi Kani, Meshkini, Hashimi Rafsanjani, Mesbah Yazdi, and others, to produce a scientific and academic research regarding Islamic governance. In March 1961, unexpected news causes grief among the people. Ayatollah Brujerdi has passed away. The death of Ayatollah Brujerdi causes all the people to take to the streets. The huge presence of the people in Ayatollah Brujerdi's funeral shows off how respected the Shia clergy are among the nation. With the death of Ayatollah Brujerdi, the atmosphere of the struggle against the Shah's regime changes and the role of the Shia clergy and seminaries become more solidified. He was in Isfahan and busy visiting his relatives when he was shocked with the news of the vicious attack of the Shah's regime to Faizia school. But he cannot remain silent and sends Imam Khomeini a telegraph from the clerics of Isfahan and condemns this attack with a gentle tone. SAVAK doesn't even overlook this action. He is called in and forced to make a written commitment that he will not interfere in such matters again. On October 3, 1963, SAVAK documents show the following comments. After the incident in Qom and the arrest of Mr. Khomeini, teachers, instructors, and students in the city of Qom encounter new provocations against the government. And one of the provocateurs is Muhammad Beheshti, who has a bachelor's degree in religious studies and teaches at the above-mentioned city's Religion and Knowledge School. What's obvious is that students have been provoked against the government by the aforementioned individual. These provocations have been deemed effective and tangible. SAVAK has officially announced that naming Ayatollah Khomeini in speeches is a crime. But Beheshti ignores SAVAK's announcements and at the end of all of his speeches, prays for the well-being of Ayatollah Khomeini. Finally, in the fall of 1963, SAVAK's worrisome reports create problems for the doctor and cause his forced transfer from Qom to Tehran. But the action may not end up to be a bad thing for him, because now in Tehran, he has a larger arena to continue his activities. With the murder of Hassan Ali Mansour by the Mutalifa's military wing, more are worried about him. His friends were sure that his name was in Sabak's blacklist because of the Mutalifa, known as the Islamic Coalition Party. They don't want this man, with so much ability, to become embroiled in a court battle and prison. He receives messages from everywhere to leave Iran any way he can. But he believes he has to stay and finish his unfinished work and research, especially now that they've exiled Ayatollah Khomeini. On the morning of March 23, 1964, Dr. Beheshti left Tehran for Kazimiya. A week later, from Iraq to Jordan, and from then on, he goes to Palestine, Syria, and Beirut. But finally, on April the 11th, he leaves Beirut for Hamburg. In Germany, he uses all of his effort in the prosperity of the mosque and the establishment of the Muslim Students' Union in Europe. The mosque grows bigger, and on March 12, 1966, the union officially begins its work. In the spring of 1970, Beheshti is getting ready to travel to Iran. He intends to return to Germany, but thinks there's the possibility that Savak will not allow it. Even though he's tried to train mosque attendees and the University Students' Union to be independent, he still speaks quite frankly during the last session. "Friends, when I'm gone and my trip takes long, don't ever gather around and say that when I was here, you were able to do some things. If the union is effective with the presence of a certain person, even if it's a person like me, it's best that the union does not exist at all. Your organization has to pave its way, be it with me or without me. Find replacements for forces you lose. You are the creations of the God of the world. You are human beings whose battleground is the world. Don't limit yourselves so much." The teacher comes back to Iran. During these days, the political and religious atmosphere in the country is embroiled by many problems. Just as he had guessed, he was banned from leaving the country. It had been a while that the Shah had been informed that religious school books need revisions. The tiring literature in these books, alongside the bland and difficult fiqh education, had turned this period into the most catastrophic period in schools. And the Shah orders the Minister of Education that the compilation of these books be revised. And the minister looks for people who can help with this revision. She reaches a doctor who many say is very educated and insightful. He has a vision and had spent time in Europe. And that man is none other than Sayyid Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti. The good thing about this is that Mr. Bourghei, the person in charge of the revision at the Ministry of Education, knows the doctor and wants to put together a team made up of Beheshti Bahonar and Golzadeh Ghafouri. The doctor likes the work and the team and accepts. Dr. Beheshti is thinking about how to properly teach the main concepts of religion to the students. He even thinks about topics regarding politics and divine leadership. He has no doubt that his cooperation with the Shah's Ministry of Education will make him infamous. But he takes the risk and enters the arena. He says, I preferred this job to teaching as a university professor as a duty and tradition. I told friends that we will take Islamic Jihad to schools through books and pamphlets and religious studies. The Islam that's about how to live and lifestyle, not the Islam that is part of life. Beheshti set a condition for his cooperation. My name shouldn't be printed among the authors. My nature does not allow me to have my name in a